Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
This is a critical moment in our country's history.
Finally, out of the gate, the massive stimulus that promises to alleviate the pain for millions of Americans. I asked the Pentagon's John Kirby about President Biden's first win at home and what to expect from the administration's maiden trip abroad. Plus, the next frontier, I speak to our own Walter Isaacson about his thrilling tale of scientific discovery in The Codebreaker and how it'll shift the balance of power from viruses to humans. Then.
This is a way for them to hold on to power, right? That, like, if voters are not going to choose them, they're going to choose their voters.
Michelle Martin speaks to New Georgia Project CEO Ense Ufat about the latest attempt to suppress votes in her state. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. President Joe Biden is delivering on his campaign promise of a massive relief bill for the American people as the House votes on a gargantuan $1.9 trillion stimulus package that is both historic in scale and far-reaching in scope. It'll bring thousands of dollars to cash-strapped families whose livelihoods have been devastated by this pandemic. And while the president focuses on COVID at home and this big win, his eye is focused on China abroad. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are due to travel to Japan and South Korea next week, the first international trip by Biden cabinet officials since the president's inauguration. Blinken is also due to meet his Chinese counterpart in Alaska on his return, and that will be the first time officials from both countries will meet. It all starts this Friday, though, with a virtual gathering between President Biden and his counterparts in Japan, India and Australia. Beijing denounces that as an anti-China bloc. So what is the U.S. strategy here? John Kirby is a veteran of American foreign policy, and he's the Pentagon spokesman. He was State Department spokesman under President Obama, and he's joining me now from Washington, from the Pentagon, in fact, and welcome back to the program. So let me ask you first to react to what's going to happen this Friday, this Quad meeting, as I said, right, and the Chinese calling it an anti-China bloc. What's your response as an administration to that?
From our perspective, Christiane, this is about deepening and strengthening alliances and partnerships in the Indo-Pacific region. And these four countries, including us, represent a significant amount of security requirements there in that region, economic requirements in that region, and, of course, diplomatic power. And so it makes sense that we would want to continue these kinds of deeper conversations with them. And it is not always all about China, but clearly China has been posturing itself in a much more aggressive way in the region, coercing allies and partners of ours, as well as other neighbors of their own. And I do think that it is important for the international community to come together and to talk about how we can better forge an Indo-Pacific region that's more secure, more stable, and is not susceptible to that kind of coercion.
Okay, so you say China is posturing itself as you've described, and we notice that the United States is posturing itself very clearly to take China as its principal foreign policy challenge, and we see all these first big meetings, gatherings, trips happening in the Asia region. So what is the reason for two of the most senior cabinet ministers, defense and state, traveling now to Japan, to South Korea? There'll be some of them going to India. And then, you know, on the return, Secretary Blinken and the National Security Advisor meeting with the Chinese foreign minister. What is that about?
Well, the Indo-Pacific is probably the most consequential region in the world right now. Some of that is driven by China's activities. We also have, as you well know, Christian, five of our seven treaty alliances are in the Pacific region, and we're going to be meeting with leaders from two of those countries, as you pointed out, Japan and South Korea, and we look forward to those discussions. So it's very much about revitalizing our alliances and partnerships overseas, alliances and partnerships that haven't always been treated with the kind of respect that they earned, that they deserve to be. So we're going to sit down and talk about a range of alliance issues. And clearly, we expect China will come up in these discussions, as it always does. But this is really about revitalizing alliances and partnerships. And for the Defense Department, Christian, Secretary Austin has made clear that we consider China the biggest pacing challenge that we're dealing with here. And so part of the trip for Secretary Austin is getting to talk to commanders on the ground, as well as leaders of foreign militaries out there in the region, to help us develop better operating concepts and plans and strategies and develop the kinds of capabilities we need to be able to counter and beat back that pacing challenge that China poses.
Mm-hmm. So let me then play what some of the senior officials in the administration say. This is Secretary Blinken last week about China.
China is the only country with the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to seriously challenge the stable and open international system, all the rules, values, and relationships that make the world work the way we want it to.
So the way we want it to work, the way we want it to. Where do you see the opportunities in the context of what we're talking about, these trips, these bolstering of alliances, focusing on China? Where do you see the opportunity to create a shift in China's behavior?
Well, it's up to the Chinese to answer how and whether they will be willing to change their behavior. What we need to do, what we believe we need to do, certainly from the Defense Department, is to make sure that we are investing properly in these alliances and partnerships. As I said, five of seven of our alliances are in this part of the world, so we want to make sure that they are revitalized and capable and ready, and that the relationships are sound so that we can meet our security commitments there, but also to encourage our alliances and our allies and our partners to contribute as well to their own defensive capabilities, and to make sure that we're listening to them and what they're seeing on the ground in terms of the threats and the coercion that they face from China.
Okay, so here's a threat, and here's what one of your allies is saying, and that's Taiwan. They're concerned, and they and all of us have heard what China is saying, you know, directly, indirectly about places like Taiwan, which are, you know, have their own independence, Hong Kong, which is meant to be, you know, one nation, two systems, etc., which is increasingly, you know, being brought under Chinese influence. But certainly your military and very senior admiral has said that they're very concerned. You are all very concerned about what China might do to Taiwan in the not too distant future. This is what he said.
Hong Kong and Xinjiang and Tibet and the line of actual control in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. I worry that they're accelerating their ambitions to supplant the United States and our leadership role in the rules-based international order, which they've long said that they want to do that by 2050. I'm worried about them moving that target closer. Taiwan is clearly one of their ambitions before then, and I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years.
That's pretty dramatic. Those are very short timelines. You yourself are a naval man. You're an admiral before you went into civilian role. So you know the situation, the layout out in the Pacific there. Right. What does manifest mean? What does the admiral mean when he says in the next 6 years, maybe sooner, we could see China Manifest? What does that mean? Against Taiwan? What is he saying?
Well, look, nobody wants to see the situation with Taiwan become a conflict. And we take seriously our responsibilities to Taiwan's ability to defend itself. And we do that through the Taiwan Relations Act and the assurances and the three communiques that have been in place for a long time. But bipartisan across decades in this country has there been U.S. support for making sure that Taiwan can defend itself. But nobody wants to see them have to actually do that. Nobody wants to see this come to blows. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important that we revitalize our alliances and partnerships in that region. And we make this trip and we make it clear that America takes seriously our security commitments. To his other point about the speed with which China is developing these capabilities, we're certainly mindful of that. We would agree with Admiral Davidson that they are moving at a clip that is concerning. And that's why, again, we want to make this trip and the secretary wants to be able to come back and make sure that we are developing the concepts and the policies, the strategies, as well as the capabilities to meet that pacing challenge that they represent. One of the first things that the secretary did when he took office was stand up a China task force, which is up and running here at the Pentagon to help us get our arms around and our brains around the challenge that China is going to continue to pose.
Well, let's just say that the choreography that we will see with Secretary Blinken and the Chinese foreign minister meeting in Alaska is going to be really interesting, because that's a very unusual meeting point for senior officials of these two superpowers. Can I move on to Afghanistan? And obviously a decision that the administration, the Pentagon, the White House has to take on May 1st, and that is about withdrawing the remainder of the U.S. troops there. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee chairman has said, if the Taliban are confirmed as not meeting their commitments, which I personally believe they are not, then we may have to reconsider the May 1 deadline. And as you know, a bipartisan panel appointed by Congress is urging President Biden to slow down this May 1 withdrawal deadline. What can you tell us about that? Clearly, it makes sense, right, if the Taliban are still whacking civilians, attacking Americans, and all the others in Afghanistan right now.
The violence is too high, Christiane. We've said that, and we've said it very, very clearly, and we want that violence to stop now. We are reviewing the Doha Agreement right now. We are reviewing issues of compliance with the Doha Agreement. I don't want to get ahead of that process. Everybody's mindful of the looming deadlines set by the agreement in Doha. And what we've also said is two things. One, we've made no decision about future force posture in Afghanistan, not till we're through this review. And we've had a chance to also pursue diplomatic ends here. But also that, and President Biden said this clearly, there's not going to be a hasty or expedited withdrawal out of Afghanistan. So we're mindful of the clock, clearly. But we want to make sure that we're giving diplomacy a better chance to succeed. And we've made no decisions about what the force posture is going to look like.
But if you had to guess, the condition is conditions. You don't think the conditions will be met, do you, by May 1st?
I don't want to guess. That's exactly what I don't want to do, Christiane. We have talked about conditions being properly set for us to be able to manage the future force posture going forward, and that's going to drive what the decisions are. But I absolutely don't want to speculate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think Congress has already decided what they think of those conditions being met or not. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens and what the president does. Can I turn your attention to the military in the United States? CNN has found, according to its analysis, that at least 27 current or former members of the U.S. military are facing federal charges in connection with the January 6th insurrection, riot, invasion of the Capitol. It's obviously a small proportion of the military, but I gather it's something you're taking very, very seriously. The Pentagon is also worried about the rise in white supremacy beliefs amongst the ranks. How serious is this, and what are you planning to do about it?
Well, we do believe it's serious, Christian. While we believe the numbers of extremists inside their ranks is small, we don't know for sure. We think it's certainly smaller than what the headlines might suggest, but greater than we'd be comfortable with. And so we're trying to get our arms around that. As you probably know, Secretary Austin ordered a 60-day, a one-day stand-down to take place over the next couple of months. That's ongoing. We expect we're going to learn a lot more from the troops about what they're seeing, what they're feeling, what they're experiencing at their levels. And it's also a chance for us to articulate again what our values are and what we expect of them in terms of behavior. This isn't about beliefs. We want our men and women in uniform to vote and be a part of the electoral process. This is about extremist ideology, particularly white supremacy ideology, that is counter to good order and discipline in the unit and also can actually harm individuals and teammates inside the military. It's about action and conduct, not just about a belief system. And we're taking that very seriously. We're going to learn a lot over the next 6 weeks, I suspect, as this stand down starts to close. But the secretary's not waiting. He's got the chiefs. The service chiefs here in the building providing some recommendations about things we can do to better get a sense of who we're bringing in and making sure we know who they are and what they believe in, what they espouse, making sure we're looking at radicalization inside the ranks once they're in, and then taking a look at when they're about to become veterans. And you mentioned veterans were involved in this January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, taking a look at what they're beginning to learn and educate about themselves when they get ready to leave, because these groups are waiting for them on the other side. We know that they want to recruit people with military training and experience and leadership ability to come into their group. So what are we doing to make sure that they're making the transition decisions in the most informed way possible?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to hear you talk about how you're going to go after it. And there's another issue, a huge issue that broke today. As you know, the Pentagon has put out a statement that you are going to start, well, hopefully, continuing your look at this really dreadful record of sexual harassment against female members of the military. And you're looking at all sorts of bases mm-hmm. to see where it is happening the worst. Let me just quote Secretary Austin to you. He has said that, you know, we've been working on this in earnest for a long time now, but we haven't gotten it right. You know, why not? You know, this is not something that has just cropped up. It's something that Congress people, senators, women's rights groups, women in the military have tried to bring up for years. We've been reporting it on it for years ourselves. Why, in Secretary Austin's words, have you not got it right yet? How difficult can it be to draw the line between unacceptable behavior and not?
I wish I had a good answer for you, Christian. I don't. I mean, we're all frustrated by the lack of progress on this. And you're right. We have been trying to tackle this for quite many years now, and we haven't done it with much success. And it's bedeviling all the leadership here. And what the secretary wants to do is try new things. One of the first things he did, in fact, on day two, was issue a directive to the entire department to come back with some creative ideas of what we can do that maybe we haven't tried before. And the other thing that he did just recently was establish an independent review commission that's going to take 90 days, and this is going to be independent of the building. They have an independent role to take a look at what we've been doing, what we've not been doing, and how do we close the gap? What are some ways that we can get better solutions to this problem? But clearly, it's happening too much. It shouldn't happen at all. Not in the military. We should have a better standard for ourselves, and we're going to work at this very hard.
John Kirby, thank you so much for joining us from the Pentagon today. Now, there are alarming new reports from Brazil, where the healthcare system is on the verge of collapse amid another devastating coronavirus wave. It is a grim reminder of the struggle against this pandemic and how a virus often has had the upper hand over us humans. But my next guest says that a scientific revolution promises to change that dynamic. You know Walter Isaacson as our regular contributor. Well, tonight, he is in the guest seat. He is a prolific author, biographer, and reporter, and his latest couldn't be better timed. The Codebreaker explores the work of the Nobel Prize-winning chemist Jennifer Doudna, both the spectacular scientific promise that it holds and the ethical conundrum over gene editing our future. And Walter is joining me now from New Orleans in Louisiana. Walter, welcome to the program, if I can put it that way. Congratulations on the book. And boy, is it well timed. So I guess for the lay person, just lay out for us, what is CRISPR? What is gene editing? That's obviously the focus of your profile and your biography of Jennifer Doudna.
Well, CRISPR is pretty simple. It's something bacteria have been doing for more than a billion years, and they're not much smarter than we are. What they do is when they get attacked by a virus, they take a mugshot of it, and they take a little snippet of it and weave it into these clustered repeated sequences in their own DNA, now known as CRISPRs. And so if that virus ever attacks again, the bacteria takes a little scissors, an enzyme, and can target it and chop it up. And so it's an adaptive immune system, which is exactly what we need during this pandemic. What Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier discovered was, wow, if bacteria can do that and chop up DNA wherever it targets it, we can use it as a tool to edit our own genes. So it's already been used to help cure cancers, to cure sickle cell anemia, and even in China a couple years ago, to make designer babies. And fortunately, it's being deployed now in the fight against coronavirus to be able to detect the virus and eventually just to chop up and kill the virus the way bacteria do.
So obviously, we'll get to the China bit in a minute because that fits into the ethical conundrum going forward. That doctor was slapped around for doing what he did because it wasn't authorized. We're going to get to that in a second. But you have called this technology the third great technological revolution of the modern era. Describe the first and the second and why you think this.
Well, the first half of the 20th century was an era of physics, a lot of it coming out of Einstein's papers at the beginning of the century about the atom and things like it leads to atomic weaponry and space travel and semiconductors. Second half of the 20th century involved another fundamental kernel, which we call the bit, meaning a binary digit. Means all information can be encoded with on-off switches, binary digits. And so you can create the computer, the internet, and the microchip. And when you combine them, you get a digital revolution. This third revolution is one that's based not on digital coding, but on the code of life. And it comes since we sequenced the human genome in the year 2000. And now, since Jennifer Doudna, the heroine of my book, and Emmanuel Charpentier and others have figured out not only can we read the code of life, but we can rewrite it. And I think that's going to have far, far grander implications for good, but also a few ethical challenges than even the digital revolution did.
So Doudna and Charpentier both won the Nobel because of this technology. There have only been 7 women to have won the chemistry prize, including Marie Curie and her daughter. And that's a pretty low number. So I want to ask you, what made her the hero of your book? What is it about her and how she came to this place that you found so interesting to profile?
Yeah, I did not know she was going to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry right when the book was about to come out. So that was fortuitous. But early on, 5 or 6 years ago, I was very interested in this life science revolution. And I met her. We started talking. And we talked about how as a young girl in growing up in Hawaii, she's from the mainland, but she felt like an outsider growing up in a small village in Hawaii with mostly Polynesian extract kids. That she went home one day and her dad had left The Double Helix, James Watson's book about DNA, on her bed. And Jennifer read it thinking it was like a detective story. And she noticed this character, Rosalind Franklin, and she said, oh my goodness, girls can become scientists. Well, her school guidance counselor said, no, girls don't do science. And that really caused her to persist. And she discovers the structure of RNA and how it can replicate itself and was the beginning of life on this planet. Then she goes on to discover this gene editing tool we talked about, and then to apply it to things like fighting the coronavirus, and finally to dealing with the ethical issues. So she became an inspiration for me, but also somebody whose life narrative, the journey of discovery that all of us go on in life, by going hand in hand with her, through her life narrative, I could weave in all of these questions about why we were in a new age, a new epoch that will involve rewriting the code of life.
And really fascinating for me, and I don't know whether others have talked to you about it, but I think she's the first female who you've profiled in amongst your many, many extraordinary biographies. And it is really interesting because, as you say, you know, women are often discouraged from getting into the scientific field. So just to reiterate, CRISPR, as you explained, is a naturally occurring thing in the body. She didn't invent that. It's the gene editing. And explain to us, because one of the things you've said is that this could shift the dynamic, the power play between virus and human being. Right now, virus looks like it could have the upper hand, but this could change that dynamic. Is that your conclusion?
Oh, absolutely. The way bacteria have used it for a billion years is they can reprogram the system every time a new virus attacks. Well, as you know, as you've said earlier in the show, we're getting new waves of this coronavirus that have different variations. I took the Pfizer mRNA vaccine, and there's Moderna, there's others doing it. Those are easy to reprogram. All you do is take the RNA in that vaccine and say, here's the spike protein blueprint. So make some of that so you can make it so that we're immune to that spike protein. If the spike protein changes, we can recode it. But we can also recode it against any viral attack. Or we can recode these things to detect CRISPR systems to detect cancerous cells in our body. So by being able to treat molecules as if they were microchips, as if we could just reprogram them, we'll be able to personalize medicine in a way that will help us fight all sorts of not only genetic diseases, but viral attacks and bacterial infections and cancer.
So I think many people will really go gee whiz about that, because there's COVID and then there's the variants, which are scaring a lot of people. And there's a lot of lay people talking about this virus and what's mutating and what isn't and scaring the bejesus out of everybody. And clearly it's a very important issue. But the fact that you're saying that this technology can essentially, I'm going to say it, tell me if I'm wrong, pandemic proof us, is a big deal, and keep adjusting for whatever variants pop up.
It's not just a big deal, it's a huge deal, because viruses mutate. They change all the time. That's why even the flu, you know, every year we need a new vaccine or something. The balance of power, as the head of Moderna said to me, Noubar Afey, and he said, this, when he got the information that the messenger RNA vaccines worked, and he knew they could be recoded every time we get a new virus come along, he said, finally, we're shifting the balance of power between us and vaccines. But even more so, the technologies that Jennifer Doudna and others have created will do things like say, and by the way, you can edit our genes if we need to make sure that they don't have the receptors for viruses. That's a little bit more controversial. Or you can edit our genes, it's been done last year, to say your genes are flawed, so you have sickle cell anemia, you have sickle cell blood cells. And a woman in Mississippi just last year, for the first time, they were able to just edit the DNA of her stem cells, and now she doesn't have sickle cell. There are a lot of diseases like that, from cystic fibrosis to muscular dystrophy, Huntington's, Tay-Sachs, sickle cell, that we'll be able to just fix. So this is going to usher in a whole new era of medicine, and particularly personalized medicine.
Walter, does there inevitably have to be, we've talked about the ethical conundrum, so maybe I'm just, you know, being rhetorical in my question to you. Is there inevitably a dark side to this kind of extraordinary technology, this kind of extraordinary discovery? And let's go back to the Chinese doctor who did intervene, and apparently against HIV for these twins. And then he was penalized because it wasn't allowed. That's one issue. Where else can you see ethics cropping up?
When Jennifer Doudna invented this technology with Emmanuel Charpentier and others, she had a nightmare. And the nightmare was that she came into a room with somebody who wanted to understand her discovery. The person looked up, and it was Hitler. And she realized that, like any technology, Christian, whether it's digital technology or Prometheus snatching fire from the gods, or that it can be used for good or for bad. And we have to be careful, like with the atom bomb and other things, we have to figure out how are we going to regulate it. And so what Jennifer Doudna did, and which I try to chronicle in the book, is she met with religious leaders, she gathered scientists, policymakers, and for the past 4 or 5 years, they've been meeting to say, internationally, with the Chinese leadership, with Europeans, to say, how are we going to have some guidelines for this? What the Chinese doctor did is he crossed a line that they've all agreed we should not cross for the time being because it's not safe. Instead of just editing the cells of a patient, he edited the cells of early stage embryos, which meant that the edits he made were inheritable. They wouldn't just affect the twin girls who were born, but all of their children and all of their descendants. Now, what he did was he edited them so that all of their children and descendants would not have a receptor for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. And you might say, whoa, in this era of pandemic, why is that a bad idea? Don't we want to edit out our susceptibility to viruses, including AIDS, including coronavirus? Well, yes, maybe so. But it's not safe yet, and I think we have to go hand in hand carefully before we cross that line of making inheritable edits. So that's the thing I worry about, especially since it could lead to great inequalities if the rich could buy better genes for their children, or if we start editing out the diversity. I mean, the diversity of the human species is not only what makes it really cool as a species, but it makes us resilient and safe. So you don't want to start messing too much with inheritable gene edits. And that's what Jennifer Doudna and the team, including Eric Lander, who's going to become Biden's science advisor, that's what they've been wrestling with over the past few years, and thankfully so.
And this Chinese scientist, let's just be clear, he was sentenced to prison. And when you actually interviewed Jennifer Doudna after that had happened, this is what she said about this manipulation of the DNA in the embryos. This is what she said.
I think it's harder when we think about making changes that are heritable, you know, that become, embedded in someone's genome and are passed on to their children. And that's the kind of editing that involves what we call the germline. So this is an area where I think there's a lot of discussion at the moment about the ethics of that kind of use.
So, I mean, I just wanted her to say what you were saying as well. And it's going to be interesting to see how the policing takes place. You touched on it a little bit. But can I ask you also about what she is doing with this technology in the era of COVID? How is this gene editing being used?
My book starts with a story because she's a mother like you and I are. And she has a 17-year-old son who she sent off to some robot building competition out in California, FIRST Robotics. And it was exactly a year ago. And then about 2 a.m, she wakes up her husband and says, we got to get Andy back from this robot building competition. This pandemic is spreading. I don't want him in this conference center with all these people. And, you know, he's an only child. So when they retrieve him, he's not too happy. But they get a text that says, robot, competition canceled, all kids to leave. And that's when she realized that she should help gather scientists that she's been working with, using these tools to detect viruses, using these tools to edit our genes, and say, we're going to create 10 teams, and we're going to now focus for the next year on using this technology to fight the coronavirus. So she creates a team that does a testing lab, because as you remember, a year ago, our national testing system was really messed up. And then she's created a new type of test that'll be a home test where it's not using this complicated PCR method where you got to cycle through temperature, but like bacteria, it just uses CRISPR to detect the presence of the virus. And her main rival, her competition out in Boston, is Fong Zhang, a wonderful scientist there. He turned his attention to doing the same thing, creating this detection technology. And even though they had been rivals fighting for patents and prizes, and the book is about their race to discover things, now, in this past year, they've been racing to discover ways to turn this technology against coronavirus. And both of them have been putting the papers in the public record and allowing any scientist to build upon those discoveries without worrying about patents if they're going to use it to fight the coronavirus. Eventually, we'll have ways not just to have vaccines that make our immune system have to fight the virus, but have antivirals using CRISPR-Cas13, which can chop up RNA and will be able to be targeted on any virus that, like the coronavirus, that attacks us. So all these things are going to help us turn the tide against viral attacks. But it also reminded Jennifer Doudna and her 50 scientist team and Fong Zhang and the group at Boston, at Harvard, MIT doing it, that even though they compete for prizes and they compete for patents, they're actually part of a noble cause. They're part of a higher mission, which is they're doing this. They're doing scientific research to help humanity. And I hope this inspires the next generation to say so.
And very briefly, though, it could also play into this inequality that we see in the world. I mean, it's amazing that Kazuo Ishiguro's latest book, Clara and the Sun, is precisely about gene editing, is precisely about creating almost super people, lifted kids who've been edited compared to those who haven't. And there's robots and artificial friends and this and that. It's incredible, you know, how all of this is happening at the same time in culture as well as science.
Right. I do worry. And it's a wonderful novel. People are, you know, all focusing on this now. And, of course, you know, we have movies like Gattaca. And, yes, what I worry about is we have a society with a lot of inequalities. And if you allow individuals someday, 10, 20 years from now, just to go to the genetic supermarket and have a scorecard saying, I want my kid to be taller, I want my kid to have this eye color, or maybe increased memory and muscle mass, that the rich will be able to buy better genes. Now, we already have inequality, but that will not only exacerbate it, it will encode it into our species. And that's why you have novels like the one you mentioned coming out that wrestle with it, which is great because we need novelists to figure this out, just like Aldous Huxley did with Brave New World. But I want everybody to also go step by step and say, I can understand now the science behind some of this, and especially I can understand the moral issues, because we, meaning you and me and all of our listeners, are going to have to discuss this as a society.
Okay. It's an amazing story. It's an amazing discovery. Walter Isaacson, The Code Breaker, thank you so much indeed. Now, this week marks the 56th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and that's when voting rights activists, of course, were brutally attacked in Selma, Alabama. Nearly six decades later, voting rights are still under assault. Bills restricting access to the ballot are now working their way through legislators in more than 40 states, including Georgia. Activist Ense Ufot is working to change that. She is the CEO of the New Georgia Project. It's a nonpartisan group that registers voters. And here she is talking with our Michelle Martin about why so many of these bills are, of course, about race and class.
Ense Ufot, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the present moment. Just this week, the Georgia Senate passed a bill to end no-excuse absentee voting. This is the Georgia House previously passed the bill with a sort of an array of changes to Georgia's voting laws. What are the implications of this, and how do you understand it?
I understand it that after Georgians across all races, ages, genders turned up in historic numbers to vote in November, and then 9 weeks later turned up to make history once again, the Republicans, as defenders of the status quo and people who are currently in power, are shook. They're afraid. And they cannot win on their ideas that in the court of public opinion, fewer and fewer people are buying what they're selling. And the only way for them to continue to hold on to power is if they cheat, is if they attack the infrastructure, our elections infrastructure, by making it more difficult and constructing additional hurdles for new Georgians to participate in our elections.
What are some of the other things that this bill would do?
Oh my goodness. So this bill gets rid of Sunday voting, right? which is, from our perspective, a direct attack on Souls to the Polls, an important program that has been a long-held part of sort of the civic engagement and the public engagement of Black churches, particularly in the Deep South. There's an element we call the Kinko's Bill that requires Georgians to submit a photocopy of their ID to request an absentee ballot, and then to submit another copy of their photo ID in order to submit an absentee ballot. I know tons of people who are smart and engaged and do good work who don't have printers in their home. And so this is a problem. Again, this is a hurdle. We are talking about, getting rid of drop boxes, or limiting drop box hours. We're talking about getting rid of local control. So at this moment, county boards of elections choose their own members, county commissioners choose their members, choose how they want to fund elections, how they want to staff elections. And it would take that control away from local control, which is completely antithetical to what has always been communicated as the Republican approach to governance.
A lot of these voting regimens in Georgia preceded the pandemic, which means that the Republicans have controlled the legislature there for quite some time. Presumably they supported them initially, right? They supported them before.
Absolutely. No excuse absentee voting is a Republican initiative. It passed 16 years ago. Georgia voters have been voting this way or have had the ability to vote this way for 16 years, thanks to the Republicans in our state. And so it is only when this way of voting was adopted by the majority of Georgians, including young people and people of color, that it somehow became indicative of voter fraud and it needed to be stopped.
The argument that many people are making from the former president, the former vice president, and including many state officials, is that people feel that there was fraud. They feel that something was amiss. And so therefore measures need to be taken to restore confidence in the integrity of the system.
Right. Well, one, feelings are not facts. One. Two, that if you looked at, for example, the January 6th insurrection, where people stormed the Capitol, where they killed Capitol police officers, where they put their feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk, where they waved the Confederate flag inside our nation's Capitol, that was based off of the big lie, right? That there's widespread voter fraud that needs to be addressed in our country. Well, these almost 100 bills that have been introduced in the Georgia legislature are also based on the big lie. These are solutions in search of problems. That there's no widespread voter fraud in Georgia. The Secretary of State said so himself directly to the President of the United States.
Right. Who is a Republican, by the way? I think it's important to point out the governor of Georgia is a Republican, the Secretary of State is a Republican, and control the election apparatus through the state and said this. Well, what have they had to say about that then? Since they have asserted publicly and to the former president directly that there was no fraud, that in fact systems were put in place to triple check the results, and they were actually checked twice. So what is their stance on three times?
Yes.
They were checked three times, right? So given that they've made that statement, that assertion, what's their posture about this current slate of bills?
Their silence is deafening. That they either have so little influence amongst their caucus in the Georgia State Legislature that, like, to be rendered essentially impotent, or they're going along with it. But they've been quiet. They have not forcefully come out and condemned these attacks on our voting and our elections infrastructure. And again, they are either super okay with it, or they're not, and they have so little influence that they can't stop this runaway Republican train in the Georgia State Legislature.
You're in Georgia and your focus is Georgia, but this is actually something going on nationwide. It's my understanding that, you know, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, which is a nonprofit organization that both tracks these things and advocates and litigates around these things, you know, lawmakers in some 43 states are pushing more than 250 bills that would make it more difficult to vote. And that's actually something like seven times the number of bills on this matter that were introduced in the last legislative session. Now, I do want to mention that lawmakers are also introducing bills in many of these states to make it easier to vote. But the reality of it is that Republicans control many of these state legislatures. In some places, many places, they control both houses. So why do you think this is happening?
I think that there are a couple of things at play here, Michelle. I think that, A, we are looking at sort of outside entities like ALEC, right, that are drafting sample legislation for Republicans to sort of push on that agenda.
Okay, so ALEC, for those not familiar, that's the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's a conservative group. It drafts legislation. It often, you know, drafts a template that it then shares with state governments who can sort of adopt it in their own states.
Yep. I think, too, that Republican brains have been addled by misinformation and disinformation, that they are, that as a result of coordinated, well-funded, robust disinformation campaigns, that the big lie around widespread voter fraud continues to be pushed, and that there are some who have a genuinely held belief that they are doing something to protect our democracy. I think the other thing that is at play here is that they're losing, that when everyone is allowed to vote free from intimidation, free from additional hurdles, free from these modern day poll taxes, that they don't win. And that this is a way for them to hold on to power, right? That, like, if voters are not going to choose them, they're going to choose their voters by carving out pieces of the electorate with these what appear to be race neutral suppression laws, but they're really not. They're designed to make it more difficult for low wealth people, for people of color, for young folks to not participate in our elections.
Give an example of that, because when you raise this, people say, well, what's wrong with, you know, showing an ID? I mean, you know, I have to show an ID to get cough syrup. What's wrong with showing an ID? So what do you say to that?
Well, what I say is that there are tons of ways for people to establish their identity, and that there is tons of research that shows that older people, so our seniors, people of color, who and young people who tend to have less wealth, are prevented from participating in our elections because they have to pay for an ID, and that is from where I stand, a modern day poll tax, that we have to spend money in order to participate in our elections. That before Georgia, the Georgia legislature passed its voter ID bill in 2005, before Shelby versus Holder kicked the teeth out of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and 30 additional states added their voter ID laws, that people could bring utility bills, they could bring all manners of stuff to say who they are. And as a voting rights activist, like an organizer, somebody who does this work, I know how hard it is to get people to vote once. So the idea that people are trying to go and vote two and three, four times, it's nonsense. It's ridiculous. And again, these are solutions in search of problems.
How do you make this case? I mean, part of the issue here is that Republicans over the last decades have made a concerted effort to control state houses, and Democrats have not, or at least they have not been as successful. I mean, back in 2010, remember that Republicans won two dozen chambers. Republicans now control about three-fifths of all the partisan legislative chambers. And they are the ones, if people who don't, you know this, they are the ones who generally write the district.
I mean, we are in the 40th, the 41st year of the Reagan Revolution. And so the work to take over school boards and state houses has been, you're right, decades in the making. I would say that in a democratic republic and in a healthy democracy, that one party rule is not in our interest. It's not in our best interest. I would say that what we're looking at is not necessarily, I mean, it is partisan, but it's really a racist, sexist, classist power grab and an attempt to hold on to power for as long as possible. A lot has been written and a lot has been said about the sort of browning of America, right? And so 2040, 2050 in some places, that the America will be a majority people of color. And nowhere is that change happening as aggressively and as acutely as across the Deep South and across the Sun Belt. So we're looking at states like Arizona, states like Georgia, et cetera. And so what we're looking at is a power grab. I don't want to couch it in political science terms because it is a racist, sexist, classist attack on participation in public life. And it's not just the act of voting, right? Because I mean, voting is important, but it is a tool that is used to sort of express our priorities as a community, how we want to spend our money. We have 12 hospitals in rural Georgia that have closed or that are about to close in the middle of a pandemic. We still don't have expanded Medicaid. The minimum wage is $5.15 an hour, right? Like people vote so that they can get elected officials who go to Atlanta or who go to Washington, D.C. to do the people's business. And that's not happening right now. And we want to do something about it. And that is why we care so deeply about preserving the integrity of our elections.
So there is a bill that's moving through the Congress. It's called H.R. 1. It has been introduced before. It would do a number of things to sort of standardize some of the practices that advocates believe would make elections more fair. For example, it would make it easier to have some of the techniques that advocates say make it easier for people to vote. And this would standardize these across the country. As you would imagine, that there's been a sort of a furious response to that. I mean, some of the conservative outlets call it, a partisan attack on democracy. They say that this is just a common sense. These are common sense measures against concerns like ballot harvesting. Somebody kind of aggregating all the ballots and, just the kind of ballot stuffing that people are accustomed to seeing in other countries. And they say they're just trying to guard against that. I mean, how do you respond to that?
I respond that America has a long history of federal intervention and judicial intervention when white conservatives lose their minds and try to make it more difficult for people of color and for women and for new Americans to gain the rights that they enjoy. I think about Robert F. Kennedy as Attorney General who filed, 50 lawsuits trying to fight back segregation. I think about the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, where federal laws that were meant to supersede racist laws that were being profligated state by state by state. I think about Title IX, again, federal intervention that was designed to force states and schools and school boards and colleges and universities to not discriminate on the basis of gender because the institutions weren't getting it done on their own. And there was this sort of mishmash quilt patchwork quilt of laws. And so to set a basic standard, to set a universal standard is in the interest of the most vulnerable of us. And we welcome it.
Maybe we should just focusing on Georgia now. I mean, this bill is passing through the legislature. What do you do? I mean, how do you persuade people that that's just not fair?
People know that it's not fair. I think when we talk about it in very plain terms, the majority of Georgians, actually the majority of Americans, because we are talking regularly to our colleagues and our siblings in Arizona and in other states, in Texas, who are fighting similar fights. The consensus is across the board that the majority of Americans know that it's not fair and that public sentiment and public opinion is on our side. What we have are unaccountable elected officials who know that they are about to get fired and are doing everything that they can to, again, break the machinery of our democracy. And unfortunately, I don't know. Like, we have made our most persuasive and our best arguments. I think all that's left now is to vote them out of office and to go to court. And to get H.R. 1 and H.R. 4 passed as a way to supersede these trash state laws.
I know that at the core of the other activists like Stacey Abrams, for example, and other activists have said that, at the core of this is this kind of notion of who is actually a citizen, right? I mean, if the core of it is this notion that only certain people are Americans, and that by definition, if you don't look like that person, if you don't adhere to those beliefs, you therefore are foreign, and therefore you are not allowed to participate. What do you do about that?
I think that I believe in the American people. I believe in us, and I believe that ultimately we prevail. I believe that there has been a continuous expansion of who is a citizen and the definition of an American, right? And who can vote. When this experiment started, you had to be a white man who owned land, right? Like, and so it's been a constant expansion of the definition of citizen since the very founding of this country. And guess what? It's uncomfortable when you stretch. As somebody that's put on a few pounds during quarantine, I know that being stretched is uncomfortable, but that is how we grow. And that is what we're witnessing in this moment. I think that Black Americans, I think that women, I think that poor people and folks without wealth, without land, who didn't own other humans, have constantly been working to credential themselves, to identify themselves as Americans, as citizens, as people who are due and owed the rights and the responsibilities of citizenship. And that is our fight. That is the fight of a democracy. And that will continue.
And so, Yufa, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you again.
So important to fight for those rights. And finally, as Congress passes a historic $1.9 trillion stimulus bill, Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan gave a fiery defense of the American worker, accusing Republicans of obsessing over cancel culture whilst rejecting efforts to support people who are struggling. Take a listen.
Heaven forbid we pass something that's going to help the damn workers in the United States of America. Heaven forbid we tilt the balance that has been going in the wrong direction for 50 years. We talk about pensions, you complain. We talk about the minimum wage increase, you complain. We talk about giving them the right to organize, you complain. But if we were passing a tax cut here, you'd be all getting in line to vote yes for it. Now stop talking about Dr. Seuss and start working with us on behalf of the American workers.
The legislation that he's so passionately defending seeks to strengthen the rights of workers' unions. But Republican opponents claim that it endangers workers' privacy and threatens free speech. Now, the debate over how to build back from this pandemic rages on. And we're going to be looking at some little-known but fascinating aspects of disaster relief from ancient Roman times to now. So look out for that. And that's it for us. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.